And hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which comes to you sporadically most Wednesdays and some Fridays, along with Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you on Tuesdays. And they're all hosted by me, whether they're produced by me or not. And they are all happening generally right at this time at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in London and Birmingham and elsewhere on that side of the pond. And then it turns into a podcast afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. We are currently broadcasting on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance as well as KABU Community Radio here in Portland, as well as my own Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, VK, LinkedIn, and Twitter channels. And today I have the great pleasure of spending the hour with a wonderful man and musician and actor and activist who I first met many years ago, who founded, along with other great folks, Banner Theater back in 1973. And we're going to talk about that. Dave Rogers, great to have you on my little live stream show.
Hi there, David.
Dave, you were just talking before we went live about your latest project, which is really kind of very representative of the kind of work you've been doing for the past 40-odd years with Banner Theater. And can you talk about what you're currently putting together and how you're putting it together?
I mean, since the whole COVID crisis, of course, live gigs have just disappeared. We were touring the show called Free For All, which was about the wholesale privatization by stealth of the National Health Service, which used to be a nationally owned and controlled health service, but is rapidly being given to private companies to run. So we were in full flow, and then all the gigs just disappeared overnight, you know. So what we've been doing since then is writing songs and reacquiring old songs that we in our repertoire, putting images to them, and doing virtual gigs, you know, stringing them together to virtual gigs. But most recently, I was just talking to you about there's a dispute at it's called Heartlands Hospital in Birmingham, where the management has in their wisdom decided that they'll use the COVID crisis to change all the working conditions of the porters. So the porters, I don't know if you have that term in the US, but porters are people who do all the moving beds and stuff like that. They were going to put these draconian rotologics systems onto the porters. And not surprisingly, the union unison, they went out on strike and asked us if we would write a song video to support it. So we interviewed one of the union activists and the porter, wrote a song, and our last viewing, it had 17,000 hits, so she's pretty good for us. The union kind of whacked it around all their contacts and we sent it around ours. So it's very much a kind of typical Banner style piece of work where we use interview material intertwined with song and we bang images up behind it, which complement the song, tell a story, fill out the story.
And the interview material is material that you guys have collected as part of the process.
Yeah. And what was interesting about that is normally when we're doing a show, we go out with our camera and our microphones and all the gear and travel around the country doing it, you know. What's been interesting this time has been using Zoom to actually get – I mean, our engineer works on the recordings to make them better. But actually – it means you can go all over the world. So we've also did a project a couple of weeks ago with Palestinians talking about the occupation, and we're thinking of doing another one as well with my partner Antonia, working with Palestinian women to look at the situation women in Palestine. So suddenly, I never would have thought of doing this before. You can, the crisis, one of the, if you can say a positive thing, it is, it's opened the world up in a lot of ways, you know, and that's been quite interesting.
Really interesting, isn't it? Especially places like Palestine, where they're so hard to get to and so hard to get out of. And I've found that the during the pandemic, although I'm doing a lot fewer gigs, when I do gigs, the billing is often extremely international, like way more international than would otherwise be possible, you know,
absolutely,
with plane tickets and budgets as they are, you know.
That's quite interesting. I mean, there's a big farmer strike going on in India, and we've got lots of good Indian comrades over here.
Huh?
So we're thinking, wow, what we could get some interviews with people on, in the occupations and in you know, and the street stuff, and write a song and get that around to raise people's awareness of what's going on. Because all we get in the news here on the BBC, all you get is COVID, and you know, but we don't hear about international news. The media is so crap that, you know, the wider world disappears.
And that's a bizarre mind control experiment I've always found, because the strange thing for many people who might be listening to this interview from the United States, to hear you in England say, the BBC doesn't talk about international news. For many listeners outside of Britain, they will say, wow, that's a very strange thing to hear this guy saying, because when we listen to BBC, international news is almost all we hear. And of course, as this is also true with Voice of America, if there's anybody out there who listens to Voice of America programming is not even allowed to be shared on social media within the United States. I mean, there is a total ban on it, which is kind of bizarre, because it's like BBC World Service is like pretty good international news coverage that the domestic audience is only, in our case in the US, never allowed to hear. And in the case of Britain, is allowed to hear starting at 1 a.m, ending at 6 a.m, right?
So
it's, and you get your sort of global news broadcast that you get for domestic audiences in Britain is on Radio 4 at like 1 o'clock, and it's called like PM. And it only has about 10 minutes of international news. The rest of it is British news, maybe European. And that's the international broadcast. But of course, if you stay up to 1 a.m. and listen to NewsHour, you know, then you get actual, you know, some global coverage. But it's so true. I only hear about the protests in India on Al Jazeera. I mean, that's
exactly
footage of it. Yeah,
I tune into Al Jazeera or RT. I'm just not talking about Russia.
As long as they're not talking about Russia.
Okay. Exactly. It's very good. Some good radical programs, you know.
I agree.
Or listen to Democracy Now or Real News Network, you know. And it's the BBC is fighting, will be fighting a battle against privatization. But to be honest, it's gotten so bad that I think they'll have a hard job, people saying, well, why defend it? I shouldn't say that, but really, the particularly the news. And okay, there is other stuff. Some of the other stuff is really good.
Some
you know,
the history stuff is great.
As
long as it's 50 years ago, then they can do some.
Yeah, exactly. But you get so. I mean, there's been the whole campaign to get rid of Corbyn, who was a big threat if he'd taken over the Labour Party and you know won the election. The BBC's role was absolutely appalling, you know, and using anti-Semitism, all these kind of stuff to try to undermine what Corbyn, who was of all the Labour MPs, clearly standing out against racism, you know. It's a cute.
And I mean, Dave, you've been at this for a while. And I mean, like you started Banner Theater in 1973. You know, this is a pretty good span of time. And I just wonder, like, in terms of like all these accusations of anti-Semitism and all this kind of like, I don't know what I would call left sectarianism, or I don't know, maybe in some sense. It's part of the whole sort of more extreme end of the identity politics movement over the past few decades. But the way it seems to have gotten to this point where basically at the smallest possible, association with somebody who said something about, against the state of Israel, some kind of guilt by association. I mean, the kinds of accusations that they are taking down politicians with in England is just really, really. Have you seen this kind of thing in your lifetime? I mean,
well, I see it now in terms of, I mean, like Labour Party activists, I know many have been purged out of the party on the most, for criticizing Israel, basically. I mean, again,
do you remember
I think
kind of thing happening in the 70s or 80s in the Labour Party or even in the 90s?
I mean, the Labour Party has always been a kind
mixed
of
bag, yeah.
It's a mixed bag, yeah. I mean, the most progressive was after the Second World War when the National Health Service was established. Nye Bevan, set up the National Health Service. But at the same time, they were in charge of deploying the troops to put down the uprisings in India. And, it's a mixed, and then we had Blair, who was, might just as well have been a Tory in terms of the impact on privatization and all the rest of it, of public services. So, the Labour Party is a mixed bag, but in terms of this kind of my ex-wife had died 2 years ago, Joyce Kainan. She was Jewish, culturally Jewish, and was appalled by just the state of Israel and building walls around Palestinians. When look what happened to the Jews, but the weaponizing of anti-Semitism to purge people out of the party and make sure that the Labour Party was a pro-Israeli party, is absolutely disgusting. And I've never seen anything like that in my lifetime. I really haven't.
And it's strange,
just silencing people. People being scared to open their mouths, in case they. And if you want to talk about racism in this country, let's be honest about it. If you want to talk about racism, you're talking about the black and the Asian population and the Muslim population. That's where the real street racism is. And
Irish people who haven't changed their names or lost their accent, I would add. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd say less so. But certainly. Afro-Caribbean and Asian, that's where the really dangerous stuff is. So yeah. My old man worked in the foundry trade. He was in London during the 30s, and at that point in time there was a big working class Jewish population in the East End of London. I mean, he was involved in the Cable Street uprisings against the fascists then, but that's a very different world now, so to see a big Jewish working class in this country, I don't think there's very much of that. And it's not to say it's not an issue, but the weaponizing of it is an issue. And I'm so sick of it, really. Me absolutely too. Sick of it.
So sick of it. And what a wonderful guy to be taken down like that. And of course, Corbyn and what a blatant campaign of fear-mongering. And I mean, just like, obviously they don't, it's not that they think he's an anti-Semite, actually.
Nobody
thinks he's an anti-Semite, right?
No.
It's a totally ridiculous accusation.
Absolutely.
What they don't like, to be clear, is his opposition to fascism.
Is his politics, full stop? I mean, let's face it. We weren't talking about revolutionary politics here. We're talking about a return to social democratic politics, of which were, predominant in these countries in the 50s and the 60s. That's what we were talking about. This wasn't a revolutionary move. Yeah. But even that is not stomachable at the moment.
In terms of foreign policy, though, that's also, I think, a concern, a big concern among the supporters of Israel when it comes to somebody like Corbyn coming into power, because hopefully he wouldn't just be giving a blank check politically and economically in every other way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No.
When you started Banner Theatre, in 73, the Labour was in power in England, right? I mean, it was like, I just think of I think of your career trajectory starting as it did at the time that Labour was in power, and there was a big strike going on, which was victorious, I believe. A minor strike? I'm trying to remember. There was something in the early 70s that you were involved with, which was actually a big victorious struggle around, right? And then, like, how often does that kind of shit happen since then, you know? But it just seems like you, like so many other artists that I know, actually started your career on a high point, and it's been basically, you know, in compared to that, it's been basically fizzling ever since, but through no fault of your own, you know?
I mean, I think politically, I mean, I didn't grow up in a political family. My stepfather was involved in Cable Street. He was a working class guy, worked in the foundries and all the rest of it. But I don't remember politics being kind of central element in our lives in any way, really. I think I got interested in politics through the folk revival, which was big in the 1960s and 70s, you know, and I started going to a folk club in Birmingham called the Greycock Folk Club, and got involved with, well, I mean, we had a policy there was that we don't just sing traditional songs, we write new songs in that genre about what's happening in the world today. And
was that a controversial thing at the time? I mean, because I'm just thinking of, like, in the early 60s in the folk scene, how kind of writing your own songs, at least like in Greenwich Village, like it was kind of looked down upon. You were supposed to learn all these traditional songs. And if you wrote your own song, you were supposed to, like, say that somebody else wrote it, you know? It was kind of like that kind of vibe for a few years, is from what I have heard. You know, I've never been part of that.
I think there was a strong left kind of current in the folk song revival, you know, so I think there were clubs which were fiercely traditional. You know, if you sang a new song, it wasn't a folk song, it couldn't. But I think there was a good number of clubs that, you know, were happy to have a smattering of political songs, or, you know, so a contemporary song. So I don't remember it that way, but I mean, the club that I got involved in was a very unique sort of situation, really. It was one of the key organisers there was a guy called Charles Parker, who was a BBC producer, a left BBC producer who got the sack radio.
Of course.
And he worked with Hugh McCall and Peggy Seeger, creating a series of radio programmes called the Radio Ballads, which were kind of revolutionary in terms of content. It was the first time, where pioneering time, when you had portable tape recorders. So, but you had kind of machines this big, which was a portable tape recorder, but you could go out, interview people, get their stories, and make a radio program with, you know, and there was a big battle in the BBC about, oh, we can't have all these working class voices because nobody's going to understand a Newcastle accent or a Wolverhampton accent or whatever. And I know he had the team, Ewan McCall, Peggy Seeger, Charles Parker, had a real battle on that front. And I think that conglomeration, that group of people was central to kind of Banner's involvement. We worked very closely with you and Peggy. They did workshops with us, and I had songs critiqued by you, and I was a brilliant songwriter, you know. And that Ewan McCall came out of the workers' theatre movement in this country, and people don't know anything about this stuff, but in the 30s, there were working-class theatre companies all across this country, in every major city and town. And that's a tradition that goes way back. Political, you know, people are going about political songs, political folk songs, miners' songs, strike songs, you know, even the ballads critiquing, you know, feudalism goes back a long, long way. And Ewan was central to that.
Was Pardon? The Communist Party was in the 30s? Was the Communist Party a big part of that? Like in the United States?
Well, Ewan was a member of the Communist Party. He formed Theatre of Action and Red Megaphone. These were street theatre companies in the 1930s, and were really centrally important in a whole load of ways. I mean, Joan Littlewood, who was a really, really important person in terms of documentary theatre, worked with Ewan in the 30s. And formed a theatre company, which was really important in London. So that tradition goes back, way back, you know, and it's got roots in kind of the blue blouse theatre movement of in the 20s, coming out of the Soviet Union in Germany. So there's a Ewan carried that knowledge, and I think that was also really, really important in the work when Banner was established in 1973. We were doing in the Folk Centre and the Folk Club, we were doing performances before that, and it took the basic philosophy, I think I would say, is that working class language is powerful. So you prioritize interviewing workers and getting their stories, not because in some patronizing way, but because the way they express themselves is generally better than the way middle class people express themselves. And that's, you know, even if it breaks all the rules of English. So a kind of understanding about language. I mean, the first shows that we did, we'd interview people, and then because of the technology, performers on stage would speak what we call actuality. We'd speak the stories that we got. But now we use video of interviews, you know, so because things have moved on. But that kind of formation, I mean, the first show we did was one of the radio ballads. It was a reenactment of a show about the miners.
And it was also, as a radio ballad, it was also broadcast on Radio 4 or something like that?
I don't know if it was Radio 4 then, I can't remember, but it went out.
But it got good publicity, you got some good publicity from that. So it was actually, I mean, it wasn't entirely a fringe affair. There was some backing from a BBC, some kind of elements of BBC was involved in stuff.
The radio ballads were like 10 years before this, but we went back and we made links. I mean, the first performance we did, we had miners coming from all over the country to see it, you know, and we had performers on stage speaking the recorded material that Ewan and Peggy and Charles had got, with a big back projection screen of pictures of pits and miners working underground. And so right from the very beginning, we had that combination of visual and song and music and performance, you know.
And so from the beginning, you had that format of getting the material by talking to people involved with the struggle and putting something together.
Absolutely.
Is this something that any other theater groups were doing in that kind of with that kind of format, that kind of intentionality around organizing the piece by talking to people first? Is that were you basically taking after Ewan and Peggy in terms of that format, or was that something you were kind of coming up with? Or
I think it I'm not aware, you know, of other people seriously doing that, but that was like central to our work, really, you know. And it established links that have never broke. I mean, our relationship with the miners communities carries on to this day, although there aren't any pits left now. But it also, because you have to go to people and get their stories, you develop very strong relationships with those communities, you know, and that's been a very central part in Banner's work as well. You know, so we get the stories. They come and see the shows. They let us know if they don't like it or we got something wrong, and we rewrite. You know, so it that process of engagement is central to the kind of work we do. In the same way with this short piece we've just done with the Porters. You know, we get their story, we check it out, and then we write a song, and then throw it back at them, you know. And if they don't like it, they're going to let us know.
And when you do get something right, and you really tell a story in a way that really speaks to the people whose story you're telling, that's really obvious too, right? I mean, you don't really need people telling you, "Oh, that was great." Like, I mean, you know, as a performer, you kind of can tell, we totally nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember when you first had an experience like that, where there was a project that was just like completely like?
To be honest, it was the very first production, you know, with the Big Hewer, with the mining communities in that miners in that audience. And I remember now one of the guys saying, and it was mainly kind of looking at the life of the miner, you know, and looking at what it's like working down the pit and about the comradeship and all that kind of thing. I remember this guy saying it was like looking at my life down a long telescope, you know, and I thought, that's great. Take that, you know.
And do you remember the first time you totally missed the mark, where you really got something seriously wrong, or did that, has it never been that bad?
I can remember we did an anti-racist show.
You'd rather not talk about it. You don't have to talk about it. If it was really bad, you could just say
it wasn't really bad.
Rewrite history. It's okay.
We thought it'd be good to have some racists, you know, expressing that. And we rapidly realized not a good idea, actually.
Maybe not. Right.
I mean, it's also about, like, there's a danger of kind of seeing art culture as a weapon. You know, I know that's a kind of Woody Guthrie and this machine kills fascists and all that, but in a way it's much more about communication and speaking across the lines and stuff like that. And so deliberately using people, whatever you might think of their views, interviewing them, pretending you're in solidarity, and then sticking them up, not a good idea, really.
right. There was, you know, the playwright and actor Tayo Aluko in Liverpool. He wrote a radio play about the Peekskill riots. When Paul Robeson was almost lynched in Peekskill, New York. And we were recording that as live recording sessions online. And the scenes when the racist mob in Peekskill is yelling, and of course the actors had to be the racist mob yelling, and we recorded that live. And now as I'm recording this stuff, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I hope nobody's just like tuning into this. This is not a good time to tune into this live stream.
I know.
Really not a good time. I mean, luckily that didn't happen, and we were only broadcasting on very small, you know, platform, and everybody who was watching was already understood what was happening. But yeah. Anyway,
it's pretty key. You're doing stuff in solidarity, and it's like the language of that is really quite important to get right, I think, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I'll get
and
definitely
where, you know, where you're overstepping, where you're creating a little too much reality.
I mean, my experience always with every project we've done a lot of work with migrants, you know, and about their experiences. And you learn as much yourself, you know, as anything else. You know, you're doing the interviews. I mean, interviewing Kurdish refugees for a show we did, and finding out about the gassing of the Kurds at Halabja. I knew nothing about this. And I knew nothing about British, French, US involvement in that process of extermination. I kind of find I think the process of talking to people, I just think is really, really important. And I just think you engage. An interview is a really special moment. I find people kind of open up. They know it's a special moment, and the way they tell their stories can be really, really powerful, you know. I remember interviewing Annette McNulty, who was someone who was Irish activist who was tried to jail her around bombing in up in the northeast, and we went up to interview her about the way she'd been treated by the police and all the bullshit had been laid on her. And that interview went on for 9 hours. She just didn't stop. She just went on, and it was powerful, you know, powerful testimony. And for me, it's like gold, really. And for me, it's a starting process. The best stuff, I think that goes for you and McCall as well. I think his best songs are in the radio ballads when he's had to base it on interview material he's done with people. I just think it's a great source for songwriters, and not just about the knowledge, but the language, the way things are said, a turn of phrase, you know, all of that is, I think, centrally important about what we call actuality. In other words, interview material.
I've noticed with what you mentioned with Ewan, and I've noticed with other songwriters as well, with a lot of different songwriters, that some of the best material is written based on, like, sort of like a project like that, where they have to write something based on interviews or based on some kind of parameters that they've been given by somebody else. But I don't know if that's just sometimes the having parameters can create more powerful work than just being able to write whatever you're, you know.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, some of the kind of initial interviews that Antonia, who's been working with me on Palestine, you go in with one set of ideas about what you're going to ask, and then you suddenly think, yeah, this isn't quite right. What we're getting back is different to what I was expecting to get back, and maybe there's a change of direction. So it's not just a one way street that you go in. Oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to write this song. Blah 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 blah. It's kind of the best is when it's a bit of a dialogue, and you know you've got to adjust where you're coming from. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about your work that you've been doing since the 70s, do you think about do you put different spans of time in your mind in different categories? Like, there was this period of time when that movement was going on and was particularly active, and we were doing a lot of stuff around that. And then there was this period of time. And then other periods of time when there was like very little happening. Like, do you have the past 45, 50 years kind of mapped out like that, you know, to some extent?
You were asking about the 70s, and yeah. I mean, yeah, after Collie Laddie, the first show we did, it was called Saltley Gate, and it's the 50th anniversary of the next year, so we're doing a big project reinstating that. But that was Tory government.
I'm sure most viewers are from North America and have never heard of it.
Okay. Well, in 1972, the miners in Britain went on strike. They wanted a 35% pay increase, which is pretty good. They got it. That was a union that had been inactive for a lot of years because there'd been a big strike in 26, a general strike in support of the miners, and they were defeated, and it broke the back of the union for a long time before they were able to rebuild. So in 1972, in March 1972, they went on strike, and it was at that point in time they were mobilizing mass pickets. So if you've got a coal plant or whatever, you'd send a load of miners out in cars, and you'd block the stopping the lorries coming in and out. Well, in the middle of Birmingham in a place called Saltley, there was an enormous pile of coal, all the pits were shut down, but this was a mountain of coal, and it had been stocked up because the government had been preparing for a strike. So Arthur Scargill, who later became the general secretary of the miners' union, came down to Birmingham and went knocking on trade union doors, leaders, and said, "Look, we don't need money. We don't need solid. We don't need pound note consciences, as he called it. What we need is people down on that picket line to close that plant down." And 20,000 car workers from Birmingham went down and went out on strike and blocked the gates. And they closed it down. So in terms of solidarity, that was a massive kind of victory. Completely, of course, you know, in terms of history, you know, we talk about, you know, pulling down statues around Black Lives Matter. In terms of working class history, no kids in Birmingham would know anything about that. Do you know what I mean? Unless perhaps their grandparents happened to talk about it.
This is so disturbing to me. And the fact that, like, it's like this kind of working class history is just it often seems to me to be the most hidden kind of history. Although, I mean, I don't want to, you know, emphasize the term most too much, because I'm sure I'm wrong, but it is so hidden, and, yeah. and is so much more hidden than other forms of history that we think of as hidden. And like I would say here, there's we are learning so much more about the history of institutional racism. Mm-hmm. As we very much should learn all about, but we don't learn about the history of anti-racist, multiracial labor union resistance institutional racism. So if we're only hearing about the racist shit and we're not hearing about the resistance to it from the working class that included white workers as well as black and brown and everybody else, then what kind of bizarre, twisted sense of history do we get? You know, I mean, it's very disturbing to me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was supposed to be giving you a rundown of the past 50 years, but the irony of 1972.
I always distract myself with my own questions.
The irony of 72 was that the Trade Union Study Centre, which is in the middle of Birmingham, in South Birmingham College, a guy there who, Paul McNeill, was head of the centre at the time, he had a mural done to commemorate Salt Lake Gate, and it was all around the room. And of course, when the trade union study moved out, it was covered up, you know, like some terrible embarrassment, you know, like Victorian long skirts or whatever to hide legs.
Oh, it's like,
that was completely hidden up. And at the moment, there's a campaign going on to get it actually back and used and seen somewhere. And so, you know what I mean? It's like, it's like an embarrassment about our own bloody history, apart from anything else. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But 72 was really important because after 72, the miners won. 2 years later, they went out again, and the Tory government of the time said, it's either us or the miners. Who are you going to vote for? And people voted for the miners, and that got rid of the Tories, and the Labour Party came in. You know, not that it made an awful lot of difference. But anyway, in terms of the era, I think the 70s was a big political moment in working class history in this country. There was strikes. Yeah. There were you'd actually hear shop stewards on the radio. Good God, believe that. You wouldn't hear it now.
And
there was a strong working class movement, sub-revolutionary, really. And I think that scared the shit out of the establishment. And particularly after Heath was brought down in 74 by the miners, they prepared for the next 10 years. It was the Ridley Plan, and they prepared to sort out the miners once and for all. And the miners' strike in 1984, which is one of the most important battles that Banner's been involved in. We worked full-time supporting that strike. Didn't have any money, mm-hmm. but we just went out on picket lines, did a collection afterwards together, petrol. And playing on picket lines, playing on in miners' socials, busking and to raise money on the streets. But in 84, that battle was to break the miners' union. It was not about, they said it was about, you know, too many pits and blah, blah. It was nothing to do with that. It was the union that which was the most powerful central union in this country, which was the Mine Workers Union, had to be destroyed. And that's what they set out to do. And the miners were on strike for a year, 12 solid months of solidarity. And some of my best comrade friends came out of that strike. Some of the women Women Against Pit Closures just were transformed by that experience. They went all around the world, all around the country, campaigning for that. They always say we weren't defeated. I mean, I kind of have a bit of a problem with that idea, but they say we weren't defeated because we learned so much from that strike. So that was the 70s. The 80s was the war against the working class in the way I look at it. Miners' strike was one part of it. Steel workers were next. You know, right across the board, there was the full onslaught. Thatcher in power, the birth of neoliberalism in this country, you know, learned from their experiment in Chile where they rolled out their first experiments in neoliberalism. We got it. And it was about privatizing every aspect of public ownership, bit by bit by bit, a lot of it by stealth. You know, because you say to people, we're going to privatize the National Health Service. People go, oh, no, you're not going to do that. But it's by stealth. It's been done by Labour and Tory governments. And one the 90s was time. That process of neoliberalism, really, you know.
By a Labour government that was just continuing the same process. That the
just continue the same process, started, you know. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, since then, it's like, well, I kind of see it more through the kind of eyes of the projects we've been involved in. You know, we did a lot of anti-racist work in the 2000s, working a lot with migrant communities and trying to tackle stuff around racism and things like that. Our union base, our central organization is the trade union movement, you know. And
were there particular reasons for the timing of the early 2000s in terms of the anti-racist and immigrant rights
work? I don't know, really. I mean, we did a lot of work with the Fire Brigades Union then, and they had a very strong black sections, and they got us in to do stuff about racism in the fire service. And it was a really interesting project for us because even the management in the fire service had to accept that there were issues of racism. And so we were doing performances to like hundreds of firefighters with us doing the show and then a black sections member of the fire brigade union on one side, a white union official on the other, and a member of the management. And we opened up a discussion after the show about racism in the fires, and that included management racism about employment practices, but it also opened up, you know, what people call banter about banter on the shop floor, which was,
more
taking the piss out of you because you're black and the music you listen to. And that, and there was some, God, I saw people walking out in tears with, you know, opening up around gender stuff and things like that. So that I think it was more a matter of we did things because somebody said, how about doing this, you know? So but always kind of holding on to, the union class element. So we're, you know, a central element of our work has always been performing on demos and rallies, performing on picket lines. You know, so I think that's kind of always been a pretty central part of the work we do. And I love doing rallies and picket lines. It's great.
And what's it been like in terms of rallies and picket lines in terms of like the past decade? Or I know things have been picking up with the Bakers Union and with some other, at least like the £10 an hour campaign. And but has there been much going on, or is it?
Before COVID, we were doing all sorts of stuff, like doing big rallies around rates of pay and in support of like care workers who were being forced onto privatized projects and contracts, doing work with workers in universities. There's a big strike in Birmingham which we supported, and so it's a kind of wide range of kind of stuff like that, you know.
And in terms of labor unions, like as organizations and their general support for the idea of popular education and theater and the kind of work that you're doing, would you say that is this becoming a more widespread thing that people realize it's useful, or is it going in the opposite direction?
Don't get me on this one.
It's so many ways things have been moving in the wrong direction, you know, in the course of both of our lifetimes, you know, in both in the UK and the US. And that's just a sad reality. But that's like, you know, we'd love to paint our trajectory of our, you know, work as something that resulted in, you know, a positive change. But, you know, it's not looking so good in some ways.
I mean, but it's very hard to measure, isn't it? I mean, we got one of the union organizers that with the porters said that, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the kind of numbers of porters were dwindling and management were going to win and blah, blah. And they said, oh, your video's got 17,000 hits and it's boosted their morale. And so it's very, very rare that you get that kind of, you know, sense that, oh, maybe we had an impact.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think a trade union movement takes culture as like, oh, one of those things you just take off the fence and, you know, you pin it up. So it's like, you're up forever battling. I mean, the number of times when we get booked on a rally and they say, oh, it'd be really good to have Banner do songs around this issue and this in between this speaker and after that one. When you get there, I don't do this anymore. I say, if you want us on a rally, we'll sing at the beginning and that's it. I'm not anyway. They'll say, okay, can you do a couple of songs after that? You say, okay. So you get there, you're all ready, you got your repertoire worked out, and then some speaker will come to you, sorry, mate, I've got a train to catch. Do you mind if I come on before you? And then in the end, you're on at the end when everybody's gone home. So in terms of valuing culture and seeing it as perhaps more effective communication than an endless string of speakers saying the same thing, I don't feel we've made much of an impact on that. I think I get the same problems now that we had then, you know.
And yet you'll go to one rally after another where if you do get a good spot and you're the only musical event at the rally, it's so obvious how people are craving the music.
That's something different.
They often feel absolutely like it's the best part of the rally. And then the organizers never seem to learn from it.
No, they don't get it. They're more important about getting Fred, the MP from block God knows where, to speak than they are about. But I mean, we developed a whole routine where we get a musical riff going, and then we look at the placards out in the crowd, and we make up chants and get people to join in with the chants, you know. And that's much more it's much more moving than endless speeches, you know. I despair with that. I can't. So yeah, I'm whinging on a bit, but I think the battle around labor movement and culture is certainly not, it's not one that we've won.
No. And I know you've fair to say you've done the vast majority of your work in Britain, but I think, right? But yeah, you also have a lot of contact with people from all over the world. And I wonder if you, what your thoughts are on labor and culture in other societies.
I mean we have a comrade who we collaborate with, Don Bozak in Canada, who's centrally involved in art and culture in the trade union movement in Canada, and we got really good links there, and have taken stuff over there in the past. But Most of our work is very much based in this country. I mean, we're thinking, we're planning to do a big May Day event, virtual event this year, and try and deliberately find artists in third world countries and get them to perform and tell their stories in the context of a Banner platform, you know. But I mean, we've done a few times. We've done stuff abroad, but we tend to work here. You know, that tends to be our base.
Just often, as an artist who's mainly working in certain countries, like, you know, North America and certain European countries, I just often feel a bit jealous of a lot of the musicians in Latin America, because there's a lot of artists like who do this kind of basically explicitly political material in the form of theater and music, you know. And there's a real tradition there of Silvio Rodriguez, 90,000 people come to hear him sing songs about the Cuban Revolution, he performs in any city in Latin America if they have a stadium that fits 90,000 people, and he's not the only one like that, right?
No.
So it's just, I just think of that whole Nuevo Canción tradition and the tradition of the theater of the oppressed. And this, I mean, it seems to be in many ways a more evolved reality in many countries than it is in our countries.
I think it's been deliberately undermined. You know, I mean, I kind of look at the whole music business in the West, and I mean, the thing I really value about folk music is it's the voice of the people. You never know who wrote a folk song. You know, there's no names on them. And people will take a song, you know, this stuff about copyright. People will take a song, they'll learn it, and they think, oh, I don't like that verse, I'll drop that out, or I'll change that one. So there's a kind of tradition in those communities of everybody being an artist. Well, not everybody, because some people, you know, don't like singing, but in rural communities back then, a hell of a lot more would have owned those songs, you know. Yeah. And I remember in the early days of the folk, we interviewed people like Sam Lana, traditional kind of farm worker in Norfolk, and he had a repertoire of 70 or 80 songs, traditional songs, you know, and they were about his life. And that the way that the music industry, yeah, with music all onwards, kind of made songs into commodities, which you sell on the market, and you know that creation of the star and all of that. I think we need a different idea about culture. We need a different idea about who owns it, who controls it, who makes it, and that. I think there are models in, and I'm not trying to romanticize folk music or anything like that, you know. I mean, we started off with a very puritanical view on, you know, electric, you know, booing Bob Dylan off stage. Well, I'd have to eat shit now.
I love that. The fact that that could be controversial. It seems so quaint, you know, the question of...
It does, and we got it wrong. You know, wow. Okay, we definitely got it wrong. But, you know, particularly when we start working with black musicians in Birmingham, you know, as we have done, what are you going to say? What are you going to... What's
electric.
Your attitude? Yeah, I know, forget it, you know. So we had to eat our own words in a lot of ways. But I do think... I think it was the early days of that movement, and I think when movements begin, they're often quite hardline about, you know, like the women's movement was very hardline, and the you know, anti-racism, it you get that kind of really hard line, and I think I learned a lot from that hard line in this country around music. And I remember when the Chileans came over after the coup in Chile, we had a lot come to Birmingham, and they obviously we made links with them because they spoke our language. You know, they were musicians and they sang songs about their struggle. And they had a very particular line that we do not sing American pop songs. That's imperialist music.
I love it.
Yeah, well, I think you got a point. I think we need to. I think we need to think very carefully about form and about. I mean, I get sick to death of going to concerts and I can't hear a word people are singing because the way stuff is mixed now, it's the voice is just another instrument. What?
I mean, in defense of sound people. So they are often trying to make the vocalists audible, but there's a lot of things working against that.
I know.
What I encountered recently, an actual recording where the vocals were not audible. And I was like, I didn't even understand why. Make a CD where you can't hear the... Because there's no reason to do that on a recording. If it happens live, there might be, it might not, you know. Yeah.
I know.
So, Dave, when you think about the future, I know nobody's talking about the future, you know, over here, it seems, because nobody has any idea what tomorrow will bring. But I hear at least my contacts in Scandinavia and Germany are talking about the future sometimes. And I think, whoa, well, you must live in a well-organized society where there's a future, you know. Are you having any future thoughts, or is it the ever-present? The pandemic.
Well, I'm getting pretty old now, you know, so my future's getting increasingly short. I must admit, in terms of banner and stuff, I think we've kind of learned a lot in this period. And in some ways, getting back to our roots about, because we used to do a lot of stuff in the early days, you know, just I look at the early days, and we were keep producing 3 or 4 shows in a year, and you know, doing stuff for building workers and car workers and God knows what. And kind of going back to kind of grassroots work, I've really enjoyed, you know, working with the porters and, you know, talking to Palestinians. So I'm kind of really interested in the idea of not just big touring shows, which we're good at, but maybe a bit more, you know, what's on happening on the ground right now, and banging those into programs, which are just this is our world right now, you know. So, kind of, I'm kind of thinking that kind of way. I mean, in terms of big issues, we've been planning for a while to do something on climate change, and I'd be really interested in a project that looked at that from a trade union aspect, you know, from a union working class prospect, about jobs that could be created in that capacity, about, you know, talking to firefighters at the moment about the way increasingly their work is about floods because of the climate change and the fact that their numbers have been cut and cut and cut, so they can't deal effectively with stuff like that. You know, so I think if we then that probably if we do the next big project, it would be around that. But I'm also really interested in holding on to kind of being able to do and really prioritize the grassroots now kind of struggles, you know.
Yeah. And what's what you got any broad political predictions on the state of Britain over the next year or Europe or the world?
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole Corbyn, I mean, to be honest, I was pretty ambivalent about the whole project because I always thought, well, it's always clever to be wise after the event, but I had a strong feeling it would fail because of all the forces in the Labour Party, you know, which do not want to go left, that it would demoralise a lot of people. I don't know whether that's happened or not, really, but a lot of people have been kicked out of the Labour Party or on the left or have left because they can't stand the politics of the new leader. So I don't know. I kind of feel you always think things are really grim, but then there's always another struggle emerging, you know. And I mean, I look at the Black Lives Matter movement over here, but that all that's kicked off from what happened in the States, and you know, there were massive demos and you know over here. And so I kind of feel there's a new generation getting involved in politics, certainly in this country, and it's going to be interesting to see where that goes because I don't think capitalism, late stage capitalism, has got many options anymore. I think they're eating themselves up, and I think the only way out of it is bottom up resistance, really. And I got a feeling that's it always does, doesn't it? Even in the most reactionary, I mean, you know, the civil rights movement came out of the '50s, which was a pretty reactionary backward time, but it suddenly exploded, and I think that's what happens in history is, you know, you never know what lies around the corner. So I think our role as artists is just to keep in there and not get demoralized and remind people of their own history and capacities, really. I think that's central role of culture, you know. You feel that in a good performance, don't you? You feel these are my people. This is the kind of love that you have for that movement and those people and solidarity, and I think that's, for me, it's the meat of culture is to be able to, that's not a very good image, is it, meat, but anyway, you know, the oats of the culture it's that kind of I think we got a really important role to play, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was talking today about all this sectarianism that we got on the left. I said your song, "I'm a Better Anarchist Than You." I think it's brilliant. You know, it's this kind of, you know, this kind of sectarianism which always gets in the bloody way of stuff, doesn't it? You know.
Yeah, and every. every political corner, it seems, it's none of them are immune. Sectarianism. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dave, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. It's been great.
That's good talking to you, David.
Yeah. Yeah. I will we'll sign off and I'll upload this and talk to you again soon, I hope.
Okay.
Hopefully,
Where can we
person.
Where can we click onto it? Is there, can you send us a link or whatever?
Oh yeah, I'll send links, yeah.
Okay.
And I'll send links.
And if people want to buy our
CDs,
by the way, can I do a promo?
Please. It's website, Deb.
It's on Bandcamp. Yeah, but it's also on Bandcamp. That's www.bannertheatre.bandcamp.com, and you can see all our stuff on there.
And on Bandcamp, as people may know, on Fridays during the pandemic, the artists get 100% of purchases. So from like noon to noon or midnight to midnight or something, I can't remember, but anyway,
yeah, it's a good time to
buy their stuff on a Friday. Yeah. Take care, Dave. Talk to you soon.
And you keep in touch.
You too. And thanks for tuning in to another episode of Discussions with David, which you can once again hear archived on my YouTube channel if you go to youtube.com/drovix, or you'll find it in the video section of the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio and lots of other places, including in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix wherever you get your podcasts. And I'll see you all again here on the internet sometime soon. Remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Till soon.